This is The Takeaway for Monday, April 17th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Is it possible for people to use their democratic freedoms and decide to step away from democracy?
Milletimiz de burada el ele verdi. Ve gerek AK Parti'ye gönül verenler, gerek...
What you are listening to is a grateful President Tayyip Erdogan of Turkey thanking jubilant supporters for handing him perhaps his most significant political victory. Turks approved 18 constitutional amendments, giving Erdogan nearly dictatorial powers, liberating observant Muslims who want to express their piety in public, something once illegal in secular Turkey, but cracking down on virtually every other part of society. Erdogan now essentially takes full executive power in the country. But look around the Middle East. Aside from the chaos in Libya, Syria, and Yemen, where there is war, anarchy, and starvation, you see other governments consolidating their power and using so-called emergency powers to create what could be called voter-approved dictatorships. Egypt's new state of emergency powers seems to fit that description. And in Turkey, the existing parliamentary system is now a strong presidential system. Joining me from Turkey is Patrick Kingsley, New York Times bureau chief in Turkey. Welcome from Istanbul, Patrick.
Hi, John. Nice to be with you.
So, Patrick, what were the people of Turkey voting for, really?
Well, implicitly, they were voting to validate President Erdogan's style of governance. He's been a de facto head of government since he was elevated to the presidency in 2014, but he hasn't had the constitutional right to wield such clout. So that's the implication of yesterday's vote. Technically, they were voting to give whoever wins the presidency in 2019 formal executive power. But as I think your question was getting at, the implication is that President Erdogan can assume such power immediately.
And are Turks looking around their borders and looking around the region and seeing instability, violence, and brutality everywhere, even within their borders, if you talk about the Kurdish problems in the east, and just saying, fix it, Mr. Erdogan, and keep us connected to Europe? We don't want to sink into this region and become part of the rest of it?
Well, I don't think the vote was a vote for ties to Europe. One of the touchstones of a very divisive campaign was Mr. Erdogan's frequent insults towards Europe. And so the fact that 51% seem to have voted for him in what is a still contested election means that people are happy for him to continue to stand up to Europe. But I think, yes, the instability that you see around the region is one reason why voters in Turkey might have been willing to stand by him. Also, even though in the West we see him as an autocrat and he's perceived as an authoritarian leader, to many people, particularly the large pious sections of Turkish society, President Erdogan represents freedom from certain oppressive restrictions that we saw under previous leaders before Mr. Erdogan came to power. For example, people who wore headscarves were not allowed to study in universities. They couldn't work in the civil service or serve in the army. Under Mr. Erdogan, those kind of restrictions have ended. And so while we see him in the West as someone who restricts democratic freedoms, in Turkey, at least some people see him as an upholder of certain aspects of democracy.
Is this a longing for the observant Islamic state of the Ottomans and a repudiation, really, of the liberal democracy that Ataturk tried to impose on Turkey and was successful for really as much as 75 years?
It has been interpreted like that, but it's probably a slightly more complex picture. A lot of the people that voted for him don't necessarily want Turkey to become a kind of second Iran, as some people would have it. And of course, there is still a huge section of Turkey, at least 49%, as the official result would have it yesterday, and perhaps even more if the claims of vote rigging turn out to be true, that certainly don't want Turkey to head in the direction that you suggested. So it's a very mixed picture. And perhaps the main takeaway is that Turkey is a very divided country right now. You have two roughly even sections of the population, one that is standing by President Erdogan and one that isn't.
Patrick Kingsley is the bureau chief in Turkey for The New York Times. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
So a divided country, a fear of instability all around them, and a powerful, now more powerful, one-man ruler promising to keep all the chaos at bay. Have the Turkish people chosen stability over liberal democracy, and are they willing to compromise human rights to stay with President Erdogan? Arrests and tortures have increased under this president, as well as clamping down on the media. Medical doctors have even been targeted by the regime, which has tightened its grip on Turkish citizens. Dr. Shebnem Korur Fincanci is president of the Human Rights Foundation of Turkey. Under Erdogan's presidency, she's faced terror-related charges for taking part last year in a free speech campaign for a now-defunct anti-government newspaper. She joins me in the studio with Dr. Vincent Iacopino, the medical director at Physicians for Human Rights. Welcome to both of you.
Hello.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Does Erdogan get a free hand as far as human rights are concerned? Has he already been given a free hand, basically up until now, doctor?
No. No government gets a free hand, and especially with a divided vote like this, I think it's obvious that human rights are even more important in that circumstance. The purpose of human rights is to protect the individual and, you know, the dignity of everyone, equality before the law. And when you have a divided country, rights should be the guide to protect those who are not well represented.
But what's the accountability here? I mean, if a country does vote essentially a dictatorship, who's to wave the flag for human rights in Turkey today?
Human rights defenders, of course. It has always been like that, because a human rights defender cannot step down from defending the human rights in the country. And we have a long history, actually. When I consider about that, it's more than 30 years that we struggle just to eradicate torture and human rights violations and just build the procedural safeguards for the country, for the human beings in the country and the society.
What's the leverage with Erdogan, do you think?
Of course, the first discussion was about the death penalty. So what do the society demand in this sense? I'm hopeful about the society and I am hopeful about the future, because it doesn't mean that Turkey would be worse, because when you look at the votes, the former votes in the country, his votes are getting less and less. Mm. So it is something hopeful. 51 is not much, and no one can just tell that his ways are justified.
Dr. Iacopino, when you think about the Turkish citizen looking around the borders of that nation and seeing the brutality and torture and horrific atrocities taking place in Syria, the refugee crisis that's overrunning Turkey, violence elsewhere in the region, Libya, for instance, is there any sympathy for Turks saying, you know, enough already? I'll take this demon versus the demons that are all around us.
Yeah, I think so. People think about their security economically and, you know, just the danger that's presented by the conflicts nearby Turkey. And that's understandable, but it can be a short-sighted view as well, because when one ignores human rights and allows for nationalism to take hold, that comes back to hurt people. And you can see this by what Shebnem is saying and the erosion of the support for Erdogan. And to go back to your previous question about leverage, the leverage really is in the people and the people having the awareness of what is in their best interests. It's not always what's in the short term, such as enough refugees for right now, to go the way of consolidating power and to have a nationalistic approach will hurt people. It erodes the freedoms that they have, their civil rights, and their ability to criticize the government, as Shebnem well knows. She's been in jail already for that.
This was also a vote to stand up to Europe, to basically say, get out of our business. Do you think Erdogan can go it alone in the region and keep things from coming completely apart, Shebnem?
It is impossible, because we know that there are some needs for international relations. A country cannot exist alone. So we depend on each other. The humanity needs each other, and they also need the other countries. For example, after some criticism for European countries, then they have to step back and just discuss other issues, because then they wouldn't have the economic relationship, for example, which would be the essential issue for their existence. So they can't continue their existence in this way. Of course, we have to work together with all the humanity, and the human rights defenders has a crucial role in all these justification process. We can't justify the situation in the country, and we have to try and tell everybody about human rights violations, about the refugee crisis, about the economic crisis also, which is on the door for Turkey.
Let's say I'm a young 18, 19-year-old who, using the internet, knows about the freedoms and places where human rights violations aren't the rule. If they are outspoken against what's happening in Turkey, what is their future? Arrest and torture? And talk to me about what the danger would be for someone like that.
Of course, in the near future, maybe it would be arrests or torture, for sure. But we have to think about the future of the country. So I'm sure that everybody knows that at the end, human rights defenders would defend their rights and would be together with these people who are arrested or tortured. The people know now. There is more awareness than in the past. For example, in 1990s, they didn't know how to defend their rights or how to find the organizations who can defend the rights of these people. But now with 18, 19-year-old young person, for example, following the social media, they very well know about everything. The young people are the future of the country. The problem is the elder who only have the means of TV set and their rooms, not knowing anything about the free media and the discussions going on in the country.
Is the future a battle between those young people with a more enlightened outlook, with the digital access to the rest of the world, and this repressive seeming government?
Yes, I think to some extent it is. And the choice comes down to this. Do you do something about it, or do you become a witness to it, a bystander to inhumanity and a ruthless display of power? I think everyone faces this choice, not just people who might live in Turkey, but people in the international community. We're all in this together, and our future, we have a common future. We've been working together for more than 20 years. And we know that when we combine our forces, whether they're non-governmental organizations or civil societies, that we do have the power to oppose these regimes, that change is possible. Look at South Africa, look at Ireland, and the changes that have happened over time. So I would encourage 18-year-olds in Turkey and in the United States to use that power and not to be witnesses to this kind of abuse of human dignity.
Dr. Vincent Iacopino is Medical Director at Physicians for Human Rights, and Dr. Sebnem Korur Fincanci is President of the Human Rights Foundation of Turkey. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
You'll recall, heading into the weekend, it was a tense back and forth between the U.S. and North Korea. U.S. warships steaming into the region, tailed by Japanese ships as a show of force. At one point, the government of China warned the U.S. to stop raising tensions and warned both nations to stand down, that it won't tolerate escalating militarization of the Korean Peninsula. But a humiliating failed North Korean missile launch was probably worth 1,000 hours of diplomacy this weekend. Here's National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster discussing U.S.-North Korea relations on Sunday morning, ABC's This Week program.
And I think there's an international consensus now, including the Chinese and the Chinese leadership, that this is a situation that just can't continue. And the president has made clear that he will not accept the United States and its allies and partners in the region being under threat from this hostile regime with nuclear weapons.
But who can reduce tensions? Vice President Mike Pence is in Seoul today, the start of his 10-day trip through Asia. Pence, the reassurer-in-chief, while President Trump perhaps sounds a bit more bellicose from his Twitter bunker in Washington, D.C. Jean Lee is currently a global fellow at the Wilson Center. She served as the Associated Press's Pyongyang bureau chief from 2008 to 2013. Jean Lee, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Did that failed missile actually reduce tensions, even though it's probably not something that Pyongyang was looking forward to?
I think it was probably better that it was a failed missile, that it blew up or sizzled a few seconds after, because it meant that the countries in the region, Japan, South Korea, and United States, didn't necessarily have to act so proactively. But I would actually question whether it's really so much of a failure, because even though it didn't do what they wanted, it didn't get any air, every time the North Koreans test a device, whether it's a nuclear test or a missile, they're actually improving that technology. Mm. They learn something from that. And so even though it's been characterized, of course, as a humiliation, frankly, within North Korea, and I've been there obviously in the wake of some of these failed rocket launches or missile tests, they are not treated as a failure. They are treated as a step in the process. And every time they do it, it's kind of a victory for them because they say we're just getting closer. So I think that it's going to play differently. Obviously, the U.S. And China have different reasons for how they want to spin it. In North Korea, it will definitely, they'll be spinning it a very different way.
What do you make of this sort of dual voice Mike Pence in Seoul today, acting more like a traditional sort of American diplomat, presidential leader, and President Trump's more bellicose sounding rhetoric coming from Washington, D.C.? Is it a good cop, bad cop kind of strategy, and is it going to work?
It'll be interesting to see how this plays out. It's still early days for the Trump administration, but in terms of foreign policy, certainly we've seen a measure of unpredictability from President Trump. And there must have been a lot of pressure from South Korea when the acting president of South Korea met today with Vice President Pence. I'm sure they wanted some answers, explanations, and promises that the United States would not act unilaterally with some sort of a military airstrike the way that they did in other countries. And so he is kind of having to go and explain what the policy is and perhaps provide some reassurance. It's certainly an interesting role to put him into.
Will the Chinese tolerate this ambiguity? Do they see this as an advantage, or do they see it as a problem in their own foreign policy?
I think the Chinese, they're very savvy. They are going to They understand what's going on here. They see the United States as an adversary, ultimately. So though we're hearing, of course, we heard earlier some sort of praise for this newfound solidarity between right. U.S. and China, I think actually we should keep in mind that they were adversaries during the Korean War. They're adversaries in trade issues, and they're certainly also adversaries when it comes to North Korea to a certain degree. I think it's great that they have this agreement at a baseline that they have to somehow bring this tension to bring it down a notch. So they're in agreement. It's a good starting point, but how they're going to get there, I think they really disagree on. You know, Trump has made it clear that he wants China to really put some pressure on North Korea and exert the kind of control that they have in terms of trade. North Korea relies on China to provide so many of its goods and for jobs and for the livelihoods. But China does not want North Korea to fall apart. China has a vested interest in making sure that it remains stable and also remains sort of a buffer zone between all those 28,500 U.S. troops in South Korea and its long border. So I think that their ultimate objectives are very different. And so we'll see where they go from here.
So, Jean Lee, let's talk about South Korea then, since you've raised that. Perhaps that's the big headline here. The South Korean government has just come through a huge crisis. There must be a lot of sort of concern about this situation that's changed so much between the U.S. and China in the last 12 months. What do South Koreans sort of take away from all of this that's going on?
So the average South Korean is fairly unfazed by all the tension. This is something that they've been living with for decades. They are concerned. I think that they're unnerved right now because of the unpredictability of what might happen if, say, President Trump were to react from the gut and make a big decision that could have terrible ramifications for the region. That said, they are much more obsessed right now with their own political upheaval. They have been in political turmoil for months. You know, they were protesting in the streets because they were so, there was a large group of the segment of the population that was unhappy with the president and wanted her out. Well, they did get her out. She was impeached. She was actually indicted on a number of charges today. But what that means is that South Korea has had a political vacuum, a vacuum in the presidential blue house for months. And now they're in the middle. Today was the first day of campaigning. So on May 9th, they will go to the polls. But that means that they have no one in the blue house at a really crucial time in influencing and having a say in White House policy on North Korea. So it was a very difficult time to be undergoing political transition. And certainly that was one of the issues, perhaps one of the reasons Pence wanted to make a point. We're not leaving you out of the loop. We are here. We want to show you that we're still committed and that we're still here to defend you.
Gene Lee, Global Fellow at the Wilson Center, served as the Associated Press's Pyongyang Bureau Chief from 08 to 13. Gene Lee, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. As science began to take steps to understand the brain, some seemingly primitive procedures at first delivered results. Back in the 1930s, a surgery called the lobotomy offered hope and then was perceived as a medical miracle, but eventually acquired a ghoulish Frankenstein reputation for butchering people. And today, there are lessons from the kind of brain surgery the lobotomy started. Our friends at Retro Report look at lobotomy in their latest documentary. Producer Barbara Dury says the procedure's U.S. popularity was led by its cult figure proponent, Dr. Walter Freeman.
He started with a procedure that had started with a doctor in Portugal. He picked that up. That was the prefrontal lobotomies, where they would drill two holes and they would basically cut brain tissue. And he came up with a ice pick from his kitchen drawer where he would go through the eye socket and do the same thing, but he would enter that way and basically mush around and sort of cut brain tissue.
As ghoulish and kind of creepy as that sounds, here's author Jack Elhai talking about Dr. Walter Freeman and remembering that he was really a kind of, you know, miracle worker.
One of Freeman's many gifts, skills, was cultivating the media, and they reciprocated with a lot of very favorable coverage. Miracle cure to the brain. Cutting the brain cures the soul. The media was all over it.
Tell me the story of Anna Ruth Channels.
Anna Ruth Channels was a young woman who had had severe headaches for years. And her husband had read about the surgery, knew about Dr. Freeman, and contacted him. And she had a lobotomy. And, you know, it took the headaches away, but it took everything else. She could not take care of herself.
Well, here's Carol Duncanson, whose mother, Anna Ruth Channels, describes the promises from Freeman and the outcome.
Walter Freeman promised she would just be happy. Everything would be fine. And who wouldn't go rah-rah for that when you're hurting so badly? When they brought her home, she did not know how to do the activities of daily living, even the most basic things like toileting and bathing. She wasn't the mother that I would ever describe as being motherly.
How hurt and angry was Carol Duncanson as she understood the reality of what happened as she grew up?
I think this devastated her life. She has devoted a huge portion of her life to finding out what happened, to getting her mother recognized. So it devastated her life.
Ethicist Baron Lerner in your documentary describes how if Freeman went off the rails, there was a sense that this was a temptation. The idea that you could possibly do something in the mysterious brain was an exciting frontier of science.
People were enormously upset about the mental illness that they saw that they couldn't treat otherwise. They were excited about the possibilities of new technology. I think we can see how many of those factors are still at play today.
Lobotomy has a role today. And that's one of the other things that you describe.
It does have a role because they understood from lobotomy that the brain could be surgically manipulated to help people that could not be helped. Now, medications came in and there are new medicines all the time, but they don't work for everyone. There are untreatable psychiatric illnesses and untreatable depressions and PTSD and untreatable OCD that need some type of surgery. And so they realized from lobotomy that if they could try to harness this and do it properly, that you could do it.
Barbara Dury, producer for Retro Report, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You can see the full Retro Report video on our website, thetakeaway.org. And now, a battle going on in the U.S. criminal justice system. Over the weekend, an Arkansas judge halted the scheduled executions of seven death row inmates, which was to take place over 11 days beginning today. The men's deaths had been speeded up to meet an expiration deadline on that state's supply of the controversial drug, midazolam. Drug companies aren't making midazolam because they don't want to be part of the capital punishment controversy, and the supply Arkansas has left expires at the end of the month. Sarah Weitz-Kotacek is a reporter for Arkansas Public Media. What did the judge interrupt and on what basis?
The judge interrupted this. She ruled that midazolam cannot be used as an anesthetic, which is how the state was planning to use it in the first of a three lethal injection protocol. The other two drugs would paralyze the inmate and cause them to suffocate, which witnesses for the inmate said would cause a cruel and potentially terrifying death.
So speeding up these executions forces the issue on the whole protocol in Arkansas. It's not just midazolam that's being ruled on. It's midazolam plus the impact of these other drugs that are lethal.
The case was two-pronged. Part of it was about midazolam and whether it would be effective as an anesthetic. But it was also about the speed of the executions. And the judge ruled heavily on the arguments about the science of midazolam. And the inmates' attorneys have appealed to the Eighth Circuit to reconsider those arguments about how the expedited process might lead to error.
And when we talk about the Eighth Circuit and even the possibility of the Supreme Court, I mean, the judiciary is really being asked to weigh in on the entire lethal injection fiasco that has been going on for years now. We recall the botched execution in Oklahoma, and it seems as though the judges are sensitive to not wanting that to happen in Arkansas.
That's right. The U.S. Supreme Court has ruled on the use of this lethal injection protocol that Arkansas plans to use, but attorneys for the inmates say that they have new evidence that this is an evolving standard and that some more issues have arisen in executions using midazolam. States like Arizona and Florida say they no longer will use the drug.
And is this the kind of thing that would be paused, or would these rulings basically set the clock back and put these seven death row inmates back on whatever schedule had been in place before this weekend?
Well, the Arkansas Department of Corrections is proceeding with plans to execute two men tonight, and a stay has been issued in the case of one. But if the executions are postponed and the state is not able to carry out the sentences while they have this supply of midazolam that expires at the end of the month, the governor will have to go back and reissue a proclamation to execute, and the state will have to find a new supply of drugs. And several drug maker companies have joined lawsuits in this case protesting what they believe is the use of their planned use of their drugs. So that's another complication for the state going forward.
Would the people of Arkansas support a change in the mode of execution entirely? And what do people say as far as the pushback from the judiciary is concerned? I mean, do they want this to proceed?
Recent polls show that the majority of Arkansans do support the death penalty. And we have a lot of lawmakers who are really frustrated about this process, speaking out on Twitter. And so inmates for the attorneys suggest that the next best alternative would be a firing squad. We have state lawmakers who've mentioned the possibility of legalizing the use of a firing squad. But as of right now, I think that for the most part, there's frustration about the process, not at the stage just having finished a legislative session of talking about instituting some other form of execution.
Sarah, the state has had this drug around for a while. Why did this come down to the wire like this?
There was another drug that the state didn't have access to that it just purchased a supply last month. And so we don't know why. We don't know what steps have been taken. There's a secrecy law that prevents information about that. But the Department of Correction says that it's really, really challenging to get these drugs because the manufacturers don't want them used in executions. And they have to go through middlemen suppliers that violate contracts with the manufacturers. And so for whatever reason, they were just able to get the third drug, and now the supply of midazolam is set to expire.
Sarah Weitz-Kotacek is a reporter for Arkansas Public Media. Thanks so much, Sarah.
Thank you.
Why is paying your taxes in the U.S. so nasty?
It's only the United States that makes it this hard.
Coming up, we hear from one expert on simplifying the American tax system by taking a look at how the rest of the world does it. But first, what is your tax experience like? Expensive, complicated, or if you're one of the lucky ones, simple?
This is Joanne from Keystone Heights, Florida. Our taxes are pretty simple, so it doesn't take much time, no more than an hour to collect our information. Then we go to AARP Tax Aid. Our return takes about a half hour to prepare and have checked.
Hi, this is Mark from Beaverton, Oregon. We stash tax mail in a closet and then haul it en masse to H&R Block. We're complex enough to cost $500, but to get IRS protection and $5,000 back is way worth it.
More taxing discussions coming up.
Well, it used to be that taxes wasn't cause for much concern, for our uncle wasn't worried over the money that we would earn. But today,
the Trump administration wants a huge tax cut and some as yet unspecified simplification or reform of the U.S. tax system. Without seeing the president's own tax forms, it's a mystery how these changes might benefit him. Some team of accountants and lawyers are possibly still working on the Trump 1040s. We've all got until Tuesday. But a simplified tax system could just tip the country into recession. That's right, because Americans spend 6 billion hours preparing their taxes or paying someone or something to help them. T.R. Reid is author of the book A Fine Mess, A Global Quest for a Simpler, Fairer, and More Efficient Tax System. He tackled the complicated U.S. healthcare system in one of his earlier books. Mr. Reid, so nice to talk to you again.
Nice to be on your air, John. Thanks.
You love complicated stuff, and you're not afraid to simplify it and tear it apart, right?
Yeah, that's what I did, and it's tax, so I put every tax joke I've ever heard in the book. I'm trying to make it palatable, you know?
We're not talking about the flat tax, the simple sort of conservative, get rid of all the progressive parts of the income tax that we've heard over the past decade or so.
Well, I talk about the flat tax in my book. The basic theory is any idea that anybody in the U.S. has had, left, right, or center, to fix our tax code, some country has tried it. So I just went around the world looking at each of these ideas to see if they work. And guess what? You know that Steve Forbes 16% flat rate tax? 12 countries tried it.
And it accomplishes simplicity, better collection of revenue, more compliance?
It doesn't do those things. Here's what it does. It brings in less money. That's the problem. The countries, most of them had to give up the flat tax because you can't set that single rate high enough to bring in the revenue you need, but low enough for ordinary working families to pay. It turns out you have to charge the rich more to bring in the revenue you need, or you have to raise other taxes. So Hungary has a 15% flat rate tax, but they had to put in the highest sales tax in the world to make up the difference, 27% on everything you buy.
In your book, it's curious that for all of the technology that's proliferated in the United States on everything else that is in our lives, that the tax system has not taken advantage of the technological possibilities of simplifying filing taxes or paying taxes. Why are we behind?
That's so maddening to me. As you said, we spend billions of hours. We spend $10 billion on tax preparation. On a beautiful April weekend when you ought to be out playing golf or playing soccer, you're slaving over IRS forms. And it doesn't have to be that way. In other countries, it takes 10, 15 minutes to pay your taxes and costs nothing. You can walk down the street in Amsterdam or London or Lima and never see an H&R Block because that system is not needed in those countries. They've made it easy to pay tax. It's only the United States that makes it this hard.
Have we created a tax-preparing industry that if we got rid of it in one fell swoop would cause a recession?
Absolutely right. That's exactly, cause a recession, I don't know. It's a $10 billion industry.
Wow.
But, you know, theoretically, those people could then be employed to do something useful in society rather than helping us figure out impossible instructions. And guess what, John? The IRS could fill out the form for almost every American family. They know all the numbers.
Right.
And when this is proposed in Congress, this won't surprise you, H&R Block and the tax software companies lobby against it. The deal is we do more work and they do make more money.
The income tax system as we know it today is this very complicated and incentive-driven system for incentivizing behaviors in the United States, whether it's corporate greed or corporate responsibility or helping people in the lower end of the tax bracket. Does it work as a social engineering system?
Yeah, sometimes it does. Tax turns out to be a good way to stop people from doing stuff that government doesn't want them to do, because it still gives you the choice to do that bad thing. A classic case is the cigarette tax. In the 1960s, the tax on cigarettes was about 30 cents a pack, and 42% of adult Americans smoked every day. Now, cigarettes cost $5-6. It's almost all tax, and smoking is 16% of American adults. So that's a case where it really worked. I mean, if you remember, Mayor Bloomberg outlawed big gulp soft drinks.
Sure.
And that it was so unpopular. It's big government nanny state. The better way to do that is put a tax on sugared drinks. And when they do that, the numbers show very clearly people switch to water or to diet soda. So tax can be an effective way to influence behavior, but it doesn't always work.
Does Japan really do its tax system the way you describe? I mean, it sounds like some sort of dream.
Yeah, in Japan, the government, the IRS there, sends you a postcard in early March. It says, we think you earned this much, we withheld this much, we owe you a small refund, and we'll put it in your bank on April 1st. That is, no tax return. If the numbers look right, you just file that card away and you're done. And that's true. About 80% of Japanese workers never file a tax return. In other countries, IRS agents, you know, they have baseball caps and T-shirts. They have bands and slogans and, you know, they brag about, and they're very respected people. But Americans hate paying tax, and therefore we take it out on those poor IRS agents.
Well, we have, I guess, another 24 hours or so to get our taxes done, something like that. T.R. Reid, it's always great to talk to you.
Yeah, I'm going to get my taxes in this year by 11:45 on the last day. I'm proud of myself.
Get going, buddy. T.R. Reid is the author of A Fine Mess, A Global Quest for a Simpler, Fairer, and More Efficient Tax System. Get working now.
Thank you, John.
Over the past few years, since this nation has refocused its attention on race, at every level of society, there's a new spirit of seeking candor. Even anger over so-called political correctness is an acknowledgement that the old rules of passive complacency about race don't seem to work anymore. We've found that this re-examination can be most powerful in one-to-one conversations. Our series, Uncomfortable Truths, Confronting Racism in America, has curated some great examples already, and you've joined in. Jessica Shirak in Minneapolis emailed us with a story about her good friend Tiffany Wilson Worsley. Jessica is white, Tiffany is black. A few years ago, Jessica asked Tiffany, who she knew from her previous job, to meet her at a local coffee shop in northern Minneapolis, a predominantly black part of the city. Jessica wanted to leap over a frustrating barrier that keeps people of different races in different worlds in this country. Jessica had questions.
Tiffany was very open, and she told me, you know, I come from this predominantly black neighborhood, and I have parents who don't like white people. And somehow I felt upset that her parents wouldn't like white people, and it made me feel a little defensive. How could they not like white people? But, you know, I guess I keep thinking of this word tracks, like we're on different tracks. We live in different neighborhoods. We work at different places. We have different people for bosses, and we have different friend groups. And so I guess I felt like racially a little defensive. But it was also the start of feeling really curious about her life.
When I initially said that, and which is still true, I did let her know that when my parents refer to white people, they still use the other word.
The C word?
The C word that I cannot even say in the grocery store anymore because it's so jaded.
Crackers.
There it is.
Yeah.
So my parents still use that to refer to white people, and that's because their historical context is my mother was raised on a farm majority of her life. doing all of those ugly things, you know, to please the servants and, you know, the maids and things like that. And so although we're in 2017 and we live in an entirely different lifestyle now, I think those memories are still resonate in my parents' mind. So when they say, hey, look at those crackers over there, they're not saying, oh, I hate them, but it's just that's them. They have no dealings with us. And that's a reality to me that I try to deal with even with my parents and some of my friends. And I think that's the kind of the temperament that I also lead with this work, is that we understand that certain ideologies still persist and consist in this day and time. And it's still live and real.
Mm-hmm. And I would say, as someone who grew up with family who said things about people who weren't white without knowing anybody who wasn't white, that there's an ideology that's really deep-seated.
Yep.
And that they're not aware of it. They just know they don't like certain people. And it's shocking that people would say those things, think those things, without having any direct experience. We went to a conference at the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, and it was the National Center on Difficult Dialogues conference. And we talked about living room conversations. And we were able to simulate a conversation on race with a really diverse group of people. And we had a great time. But it was also hard to be in a room of people who mostly weren't white and talk about having these cross-racial dialogues and feel challenged. What an example of a time where it got a little weird for me, but then I understood what other people's experiences must be like, was when I was talking about something, but the black women in the room looked at Tiffany and addressed Tiffany for follow-up questions. They didn't necessarily address me. That's probably the experience of a lot of people of color in America every day.
After that experience, we were going to dinner that night.
Mm-hmm.
And as we were walking in the door, you said you needed a break, you need to go for a walk. And it was in that moment I thought of the pressure that you were or had experienced, and you needed to walk it off. And I thought to myself, I don't get that opportunity to do that. Mm. I can't, because this is my reality. Mm. And so that has been one thing that I've been thinking about, but never intentionally like got into until now.
Yeah.
I just didn't think me and white women had a lot in common. I think because I put them all in this one bucket of passive women who didn't have much to say and or contribute outside of beauty and hair. And when I think of white women, it's just beauty. And I don't know if that's because that's how society lifts them, you know, because they're always the models, or look at what she has on, or, you know, she's size 4, the long hair, the straight long hair, because mine is not straight. So, of course, I always gravitate to those things that are obviously much more different than us. So as I began to do the living room conversations, I began to see her nose. I began to see the color of her hair, which meant I began to listen when she talked. So when she talked about her relationships, when she talked about her beautiful marriage and her beautiful daughter, I began to see my auntie and my cousins, when they talk about their beautiful marriages and their children, also her work. I already thought Jessica was a strong woman, so to hear her talk about her work and how she moved around in her work, it was just like, she is just like me. Now, I can honestly say I don't know that I hold that for still all white women. I need more white women friends. But for Jessica, I think she was a little bit more easier for me to see, because I had already pegged her as someone who was strong and hardworking, and she cared about her appearance. And obviously those things are big for me, and I don't know why, but they are.
So can I bring up the hair thing? You mentioned it, the long straight hair.
Yep.
So I learned a lot of things, and these, they might seem silly, but they weren't silly to me. I learned that black women sometimes, if they get their hair done for a particular kind of event, they might sleep sitting up in a chair because they don't want to ruin their hair, because it's important that it looks good the next day. Tiffany might, I mean, has a lot of familiarity with that, but I didn't know that. And it seems like a small detail of life, but it lets you know that we are having really different experiences in daily details of how we go about our lives. And it was really surprising to me that there were small things like that that I didn't know, like how to care for your hair that every black woman is going to know, but most white women will not know. I didn't know that black women wore wigs. Mm-hmm. I had no idea. And then I went to Tiffany's apartment, and she had wigs at her house. And I was like, whoa, what's going on here? I don't know white women who have wigs. But now I know that small detail, but it helps me understand life just a teeny bit more from somebody else's perspective. And I think about other white women who are going to go through their lives having only white women friends and not knowing at all what it's like for someone who's not white to just get around in the world, to be in the world. And I think that is too bad for them.
That's Jessica Shurack and Tiffany Wilson Worsley. Now they are both participating in Living Room Conversations, a guided conversation project about helping people connect with others with differing perspectives. And we're grateful they were a part of our series, Uncomfortable Truths. If you want to take part in our series, well, we'd love to hear from you. Visit thetakeaway.org/truths. Tell us how you could bridge racial divides in your world by having a conversation. Could be with a family member, a friend, or a coworker. We'll review your submission, and if we select your story, we'll set everything up to record your conversation. Again, visit us at thetakeaway.org/truths to sign up. That's all from us. Keep bridging those divides, one conversation at a time. That's our mission. Thanks for joining us. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, offering copy and print solutions for business materials printed in-store or ordered online, including business cards, presentations, large banners, and posters. More at Staples and Staples.com. Staples, make more happen. Bluevine, offering businesses revolving lines of credit to help them grow and to expand. Credit lines up to $100,000. Small business credit help is available at bluevine.com. TIAA, whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA believes smart financial decisions should enable life, not define it. TIAA calls this the new success story. Learn more at TIAA.org. From Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving, training programs that draw from 50 brain games, and tools to compare scores with global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com. LegalZoom.com, helping Americans plan for their family's future with estate plans that include legal guidance provided through LegalZoom's network of independent attorneys. More information available at LegalZoom.com/takeaway. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.